So while we wait, I guess we'll sort of just get started. So each speaker is going to have 1 minute and one slide in which to describe their work. And we have a timer set, so each person really just does get a minute. And at the end of each minute, we'll do something called a power clap. So it's just one clap, and we'll just have a practice. So one, two, three, clap. Okay, so recap, one clap at the end of each talk. So I guess we'll get started. So our first speaker is Konstantinos Kyriakopoulos, telling us about a deep learning approach to automatic characterization of rhythm and non-native English speech.
Sometimes overlooked but important aspect of learning a language, in this case English, is rhythm. So the pattern of durations of vowels and interval intervals. Automatically characterizing or assessing rhythm is important for proficiency assessment, accent detection, and other tasks related to language learning and beyond. What we've done in this work is we've taken the theoretically grounded metrics used for rhythm assessment in the literature, specifically PVI and CCI, and we've generalized them to a hierarchical deep learning attention LSTM-based model, which is end-to-end trainable, tunable to any task, and is able to predict the proficiency and L1 of a speaker better than baseline and than humans. So if you want to find out how this works, don't neglect to visit poster one.
Our second speaker is Mandy Wigodoritz, telling us about a holistic measure of sociolinguistic experience, a contextual and individual linguistic diversity in South Africa and the United Kingdom.
Both active and passive language exposure can be influenced by one's socio-environment, but there's been little research on passive language input that affects one's overall language knowledge, particularly in contexts that differ in sociolinguistic diversity, such as South Africa and the UK. As such, there's a need for a valid and reliable measure that captures important aspects of language experience as derived from one's sociolinguistic context. To address this, myself and colleagues developed the Contextual and Individual Linguistic Diversity Questionnaire. We tested the SILDQ on 353 participants across South Africa and the UK, and following an exploratory factor analysis, found that it is comprised of three factors: multilingualism in context, multilingualism in practice, and societal promotion of language diversity. We also found that South Africans scored higher than participants from the UK across all the scales, even when split into mono, bi, and multilingual groups. To find out more about this measure and how it can be used in practice, come visit me at my poster.
Okay, next up is Sena Kidwai telling us about automatic language identification in code-switched Hindi, English, and media texts.
So our aim was to automatically assign language tags to a bilingual corpus, and this is sort of what our data looked like. There were many challenges working with this data. Firstly, it was incredibly messy, so there were URLs, emojis, hashtags, etc., as you can see on the slide. Another problem was that Hindi was transliterated, and there's no standardized way of doing this. So for example, the word hair, which means is in Hindi, is spelled as H-A-I in the tweet and as H-E in the last comment on the Facebook post. We also had several forms that could be words in either language, and these were often really high-frequency words as well. So for example, the form A-R-E, which has been circled on the WhatsApp chat, could be the word R in English, or as in this context, the discourse marker Are in Hindi. So you'll have to come to poster three to hear more about the challenges that we faced and how we overcame them and eventually achieved an overall accuracy of almost 95%. Thank you.
Next speaker is Jody Weber telling us about an assessment of the knowledge, attitudes, and practices of slum-dwelling mothers pre- and post-Hodoto model of intervention in Kokoda Mobile Teaching Kitchen Project.
Our poster presents a pilot study of mobile teaching kitchens, a project launched in Calcutta, India by NEDPRO. Following a see one, do one, teach one model and through storytelling methods in the primary local language, volunteers taught groups of slum-dwelling women about nutrition and sustainable cooking. Through the teach one component, the women pass on their knowledge to peers, and we see the interdisciplinary impact beyond just improving nutritional status. Analysis of a Teach One self-assessment found associations with the demographic characteristics of education, employment status, and income. Pre- and post-intervention analysis indicated overall improvements to the knowledge, attitudes, and practices of these women. Moving forwards, Language data from the storytelling element will allow us to consider changes in the complexity and coherence of the women's language use. Come along to our poster to learn more about the results of the pilot and their implications for the future of the MTK project.
Our next presenter is Victoria Poulton, telling us about Can You Hear What's Coming? An ERP study of phonological prediction.
Okay, so we're going for a little bit of audience participation here. I'm going to read this sentence out, and I'd like you to complete it for me. The waiter placed the dishes down on the
table.
Excellent. So I want you to think about whether or not you were waiting until you heard all the evidence for that sentence, or were you actively predicting the word that you thought would come next? We wanted to distinguish between phonological and semantic prediction in this project to see if we could find neural correlates of either process. So, for example, if you heard that sentence ending in a word like cable, which is phonologically related but semantically unrelated, what does the brain signal look like upon encountering that word? If you want to find out more about what we saw or didn't see in the brain, you can come by poster 5.
Our next presenter is Rebecca Whiteman, telling us about characterizing musical interaction, an exploratory video analysis.
When we perform music, we focus just on keeping the interaction going. We don't refer to anything else, but we foreground the phatic. In speech, we talk about something. We work together to build common ground. I set up case studies to understand this distinction. I gave my participants kazoos, and I told them to interact in pairs. My no-goal pair, I told them just interact. I told another pair to interact in order to depict birds or elephants. I analyzed my videos, and I looked at synchrony, and I found that my participants in the no-goal condition played much more in time with each other. I also looked at patterns of gaze. I found that in the no-goal condition, they looked towards each other right before they played something together. But in the bird goal condition, they took turns. They looked away before starting their turn and then checked back after. This is initial work which shows the difference between more musical and more speech-like forms of interaction. Thank you.
Our next presenter is Min Du, telling us about designing and developing a virtual English enrichment course for improving Chinese learners' communicative competence in English.
As an English as a foreign language learner, I was brought up in China and learned English initially in China. I only came to the UK to study a master's degree, PGC course, and become a maths teacher. However, over those years, I realized what was most important and difficult for me was to whether I'm willing to or able to integrate to the local British culture and whether I enjoy my communication with others. And I also know that many other Chinese learners also have similar problems. That was why I decided to do this study. As you can see, this course is composed of synchronous learning and asynchronous learning. And for the assessment, I evaluated the course. The students per se, it has proved it was a very effective course, especially for developing students' sociocultural competence. And there are already 15 Chinese schools signed up to integrate this program into their school English education. And I'm also looking to develop more about asynchronous learning in this project. If you want to talk more with me about it, please come to poster stand 7. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Daria Dashkevich, telling us about Greek accented pronunciation of Russian coronal fricatives.
Russian phonetic system is very rich in consonants, especially in coronal fricatives. This research shows main difficulties in mispronunciations in Russian speech in Greek for Greek speakers. And after asking some Greek Greek participants to read special reading materials for us, we analyzed their speech. And the main problems that we found out were differentiation between palatalized and varalized consonants in Russian, for example, sin instead of sin, a differentiation of Russian affricates at ts and ch, and mixing affricates and fricatives like china or cena, utitsa instead of uchitsa, and others. The results of this research may be implemented in Russian pronunciation courses for Greek students. And if you want to find out more, please come to poster number 8.
Our next speaker is James Thorne, and he'll be telling us about how our fact verification system brings to linguistic change.
Hi there, my name is James Thorne, and I work on fact verification, which is the task of predicting whether written information is true or false against evidence. Because this task has a potentially sensitive application, it's critical to understand the limitations of the natural language processing systems which are deployed for it. And these systems are typically deep learning and trained using supervised data sets, which only capture a subset of the English language. In this example behind me, you can see how the use of passive voice rather than active voice causes the system to mispredict the label for a task, which highlights potential limitations and ways which systems can be gained. However, this is also how we look at improving systems and making them more resilient to these sorts of variations. So if you want to come and learn how to lie to a computer, come to poster number 9. Thank you very much.
Next, Xin-Ken Wang will tell us about neural computations of prediction error can explain imagery response during recognition of spoken words and pseudo words.
How do human brains process spoken words? One unique phenomenon that helps us understand spoken word recognition is the competitor priming effect. For example, hearing the word hijack would delay the recognition of the competitor word hygiene, which shares the same initial segments hijack. Models supporting competitive selection accounts propose that this is due to lateral inhibition caused by lexical competition, which makes the competitively primed word hygiene less activated than before. However, predictive selection accounts suggest that prior presentation of hijack enhances segment prediction between hijack and ack. Therefore, on hearing hijack in, greater prediction error was evoked, which delays its recognition. Our MEG study found evidence in favor of predictive selection accounts. Please come to poster 11 to find out more.
Next, we have Jacqueline Phelps telling us about neural tracking of attended speech in monolingual and bilingual children.
Studies of adult bilinguals and monolinguals have found neural differences exist even when behavior is the same. We wanted to find out if this was also true of children. So conducted an EEG study of children performing a selective listening task. The task was a cocktail party design in which children had to attend to 4 different target stories in English whilst ignoring 4 different levels of interference. We tracked behavior by asking them simple comprehension questions about each story. We tracked neural response by correlating or seeing how correlated the EEG data was with the speech envelope as a measure of entrainment. We found that even though their comprehension scores were comparable, there were certain key patterns of difference between the levels of entrainment, which mirrored those of adult bilinguals. Therefore, this suggests that that neuroplastic change as a result of bilingualism is established by the time that children can reliably respond to selection tasks. Come to my poster 12 to find out more.
Next, we have Zilin Wang telling us about No, You're Not Alone, a better way to find people with similar experiences on Reddit.
Hi, so my name is Zilin, and just to show your hands, how many of you have used Reddit before? How many of you have asked a question on Reddit before? Not that many. Okay, anyway, the data set that we're working with is this subreddit called Advice Subreddit, where people with problems troubling them go onto this subreddit and ask for some advice. And the problem we found was that a lot of these questions were similar, but it's not necessarily intuitive how people can find related experiences on this subreddit. So the reason is because a lot of these experiences, they're not simply based on keywords as normal search engines work, but they're based on the contextual meaning of words together, revealing a certain situation that individuals are faced. So we use recent advances of like BERTs, that is a very big thing in the NLP community. And we use that to kind of cluster similar experiences together. Come along to poster 13 if you want to find out more about this.
Next up, we have Alexander Karen Cross telling us about post-verbal subjects in Italian monolingual children.
So what's going on behind me? You might say there's a turkey driving a car or a turkey driving a car, in which case Italian children would generally agree with you as they learn that their subjects are canonically pre-verbal at a very young age. However, there are also a number of contexts in which you can get a post-verbal subject in Italian. One of those is if we change the verbal semantics, you can say very easily, is arrived a turkey. Another way that we could do this is by changing the actual discourse context and ask who is driving the car. driving the car a turkey or driving a turkey. But these require different types of information to be integrated in your syntax. So we ask, do children know both of these types of subjects exist? And if so, do they differentiate based on their restrictions by the age of 6?
Next, we have Chen Yang Zheng telling us about prosodic correlates of gapping in Mandarin Chinese.
Hi, my project is about gapping. So constructions like we like Americans and they Germans, which is quite common English. So where the verb in the second conjunct is missed out. But however, the parallel constructions in Mandarin Chinese can be ambiguous due to the competition with identity expressions. So specifically, the verbless clauses like they Germans in Mandarin can be interpreted as either a identity expression, they are Germans, or a gapping expression, they like Germans, so where the elided verb can be recovered according to the previous discourse. So in the present project, we look at the prosodic features of gapping to see if gap can block tone 3 sandy, cross it, or the gap can be marked by any pre-gapping lengthening. So if you want to know the end of story, please come to see poster number 15.
Our next speaker is Jacob Dunn, telling us about rapid evolution of primate larynx.
So very good afternoon. My name is Jake Dunn, and I'm interested in the comparative anatomy of the larynx and what this might tell us about the evolution of vocal communication systems. So in this project, we created 3D models from 55 different species of two orders of mammals, all the way from pygmy marmosets to gorillas among the primates, and from dwarf mongooses up to Siberian tigers among the carnivorans. And what we see in the right-hand side over here are plots of body length against larynx size, and using phylogenetic comparative methods, we found 3 key results. Firstly, primates have a significantly larger larynx for their body size than carnivorans. Secondly, primates show much more variation around the regression line, so they have a much more deviation from the expected allometry. And thirdly, primates show a significantly higher rate of evolution in the larynx than carnivorans, with much more accumulation of variation per unit of time. So what this might mean, I'd be interested to discuss at the poster whether it has any relevance for our understanding of vocal communication in humans. I look forward to seeing you at the poster. Thanks.
Our next presenter is Philippa Steele, telling us about script birth and script death, an interdisciplinary investigation.
At the Cruise Project, we're working on a number of different languages in the Eastern Mediterranean area in the second and first millennia BC. Our poster today looks at script birth and script death. So thinking about the creation, adaptation, and loss of writing systems in the ancient world. Here we have an example of two writing systems that are structurally very similar to each other in the way that they encode language, and they were used for two closely related languages. However, one of them died out in the Late Bronze Age, the Ugaritic cuneiform alphabet, while the other one, the Phoenician linear alphabet, survived long term. But why? Please come and talk to us on poster 18 to find out more. Thank you.
Our next speaker is Jonathan Goodman, telling us about the cost of faking, a pilot study into the evolution of human accents and language.
Thank you. We're interested in understanding the co-evolutionary relationship between accent mimicry and accent detection, and whether that relationship may be helpful for explaining why accents are so complex today. Take, for example, the biblical story of Shibboleth, where members of one tribe detected members of another and killed them based on how they pronounced the word. Well, what if members of the second tribe were able to effectively mimic how members of the first pronounced the word Shibboleth? Would they be at a selective advantage? We think so, and so we're hypothesizing, that accents are a good example of what's called in evolutionary biology a Greenbeard effect, where some discernible feature represents a kinship affiliation. If that's true, we'd expect selection pressure both to be a good mimic and for others to be good at detecting mimicry. This has led us to make some rudimentary hypotheses in this area. Come and see our results.
Our next speaker is Tim Lamars, telling us about the influence of linguistic and non-linguistic factors in second language acquisition of tone.
Hello, I'm going to teach you 4 words in a foreign language. Mon, 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 mon. Does this confuse you? This is because this is what we call a tonal language, where the relative pitch of the word affects a word's meaning. Unlike English, most of the world's languages are in fact tonal. And it is known that second language learners of tonal languages find tones very difficult. However, would tones be more easy, would be easier if you already speak a tone language yourself? Or would if you play a musical instrument, would that help you in learning tones in a second language? If you're interested in how linguistic and non-linguistic factors affect second language acquisition of tones, come check out my poster.
Our next presenter is Chaim Dubosarski, telling us about Time for Change, evaluating models of semantic change without evaluation tasks.
Hello. As we all know, as Marika nicely exemplified in her talk, words change their meaning over time. So, for example, broadcast used to denote a technique of spreading seeds in the field, and now denotes a spread of electromagnetic waves over the ether. And cell used to refer to a small, confined physical space, now refer to mobile phone. And meat used to narrow from any staple food to what we now call meat. So recently, the availability of a large historical corpora combined with modern technique in NLP that allows for automatic extractions of word meaning from text was proposed in order to model and detect words that underwent semantic change. However, this kind of models crashed against the problem of evaluation because there is no agreed upon and validated list of words that underwent semantic change or stable words, so we were not able to evaluate our models. Sadly, also, recent research have proposed that previous model actually of super sensitive to noise, and most previous reported results were in fact invalid. If you're interested more about the problems in current research, but of course, much more importantly, what can we do in order to alleviate this kind of concern so we could still use computational models to study semantic change, please come to my poster number 21. Thank you.
Last but not least, we have Carlos Bahana, who will be telling us about TORS, an automated event semantic representation of L2 learner inflectional errors.
So corpus studies in second language acquisition provide some strong evidense that the types of tense and aspect errors that learners produce, and also the context in which these errors occur, are influenced by lexical features of the verb and also information structure, so whether the verb expresses new or established information. Meanwhile, in the natural language processing world, grammatical error correction systems seem to significantly underperform on these kinds of errors relative to other error categories. Now, this is partly because these errors appear well-formed in isolated semantic contexts, and also because learners will shift tense use in narrative tasks to describe synchronous events. So to address these issues, we've been developing an annotation and event extraction framework, which produces feature-rich semantic representations. That includes both lexical features in the bottom row and also global features that express temporal orderings between events. To learn about our new annotation tool, our gold standard annotated set, and some initial results from our evaluation, please come see me in poster 22.
All right, and that was it. Thank you so much, everyone, for your attention. And yeah.